Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
Guys, welcome to West Point, Mississippi, home of Mossy Oak Brand Camo, the Gamekeeper Studio. And today, Toxie, I am so excited about the guest that we have today.
Yes, as we all are.
Lanny.
Yes.
Can you believe it?
We got Jim Shockey on the line.
Jim Shockey.
The man.
That's right.
Dare I say we have a man crush on him, but he
Bobby,
the things that he's
going to run him off, Bobby.
He's a naturalist, an outfitter, a television producer. He's a professional hunter. He's been all over the world. He's a conservationist. He's very well spoken. And now he's an author.
Y'all've got even more things in common.
I'm just so excited to have him. I am so excited to have him. Jim Shockey, welcome.
Oh, thank you, guys. That's pretty high accolades. I'll try and live it up to them, especially the well-spoken part. not sure I'll be able to live up to that one, though.
So I have to tell on him. We've been 15 minutes late getting started because, as everybody out there that follows him would hope, he is a completely technology nerd like me, and he couldn't get the sound right, and also I think that even proves more he's the real deal.
That's exactly right.
He is not a technology guru at all.
Well, you got that one right.
You know, you're kind of on a book tour. You're going to a lot of the Bass Pros and Cabela's and other great bookstores and promoting the new novel that you have. And it looks like it's being super successful, super well received. The reviews are fantastic. And how is that going? Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Brand new industry for me. Believe me, it's totally different than our world. Getting into, you know, trying to get a novel published by a big publisher out of New York City is not easy. And this is the book tour part of the release, which they released it 2 weeks ago. So I'm on a tour of bookstores and also Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops. You know, the New York City publishers had never the twain shall meet with us, you know, with us outdoor people. So, you know, they'd have book people that go to bookstores. So they were kind of shocked when I said, hey, I don't want to do, you know, all bookstores. I want to do Cabela's and Bass Pro as well, because that's where, you know, we live.
Yeah.
And so it's, I think they've been shocked. I did some videos, and I think there were 700 people showed up the other day in West Virginia to the Cabela's basketball there, and they, you know, the bookstore people, in one event there was 4 people, so it's like, you know, I think they're getting a real sense of you know, how strong our family, our outdoor family really is.
It is a great community, no doubt about it.
I would just imagine when he sits down and starts putting pen to paper, he's had so many adventures to pull from.
Look, I've been 37, 38 years, approaching 40 years in the industry. And I mean, this isn't just to patronize him or anything. It's just a fact. There is nobody that has brought more of the adventures of the world and the greater good of conservation, and especially the exhilaration of hunting. But the whole experience, nobody in our lifetime has done it. I mean, you really have, and I think you sit there and watch him. He never steps back and gets caught up in his own like fame or accomplishments or anything. He is on to the next thing. He's the most productive and busy person I've ever seen. So hats off to you. And I mean, the point of that is he's got that lifetime to draw upon to bring us, you know, the written word of stuff. And I can't wait to read it.
It's a fictional thriller. And what I tell people, it should be classified as an autobiographical abstract fictional thriller, and because it's highly autobiographical. I've woven a fictional story through my adventures and things that have happened in my life. You know, what I tell people is it's 80% true, and the 20% that would put anybody in jail, that's the fiction part. nudge, and a wink, wink. So it's it was a lot of fun to write it, and this is really the prequel, the parts that people maybe didn't know about me before I got into the hunting world. So the sequel to this one will be more of what people know me for, the hunting part.
How is when you've dealt with the New York, with the agency, the book selling people, how is the hunting part of this received with them?
What I did on this novel, it's not a hunting book. So it's not about hunts. It's not Hemingway going to the green hills of Africa. But I flipped the stereotypes around. So the villain is an animal rights extremist.
There you go.
And the anti-hero, he discovers that he's a hunter later on. But the protagonist is actually a young lady in her 20s, and her sidekick, so Nyala Luba. And so the story, they read it, and you absolutely have to hate the villain. He's just the worst villain that ever existed. But if your ideology coincides with what he thinks, then it's difficult to hate him, but you can't admit as you like them. So I flipped the stereotypes, and I think that fascinated the people in New York City. And it's well written. I published 1,000 articles for hunting magazines. I hone the craft and the skill, and storytelling is what we do. I mean, you guys do on television. There's no difference. It's storytelling. And it's well written. It's a good story. There's so many twists and adventures in this plot that they had never heard of, because they're kind of caught in their world, whereas we get to go out there and live. So it was challenging. On the other hand, it was good enough that they had to kind of accept it. But the critics, they're academically oriented, and they're also a lot of times stuck in ideologies. So their readers love it. But they just recently, I should have been on the New York Times bestseller list. We sold more books than some of the books that they had on the list for last week. But mine was algorithm off the list.
Oh.
So yeah, we're still dealing with that no matter what. But they can't stop people from reading it and liking and telling their friends and giving it out for gifts for Christmas. And it's going to make a difference on the perception of hunters and hunting. When this is all done, they vilify and marginalize us and stereotype us as Neanderthals that sit on the floor and can't speak, can't put a sentence together. So this is done well enough that they have to give me a voice in mainstream media. They have to. And once they do, then I'll be able to articulate to them what hunting is really all about, what we are all about. And that's my hope on this novel. It's not about making money or for ego. It's purely to get a voice in mainstream media that we haven't had for 60 years, probably.
That's great. So you're going into this to make a difference. And it's so cool to me that you have an acclaimed publisher, Simon & Schuster. I mean, that's a big deal.
It's not only Simon & Schuster, Emily Bessler, who's the rock star of editing. She's discovered many of the modern best-selling authors. That's her stock and trade. She personally chose to edit this novel.
That's great.
And it was important to do that route. I could have self-published and made way more money. I mean, way more. We, you know, I could have sold every copy self-published. But if you don't play by the rules that they set out, then they say that you're circumventing the rules. And so I went the route that any true respected novelist has to go. And that's out, you know, in the mainstream, do it the way they do it, which, and I wouldn't settle for a lesser publisher than Simon & Schuster. That's who I wanted. And honestly, Emily Bessler was the only one I wanted. Because it means you're automatically vetted. You're vetted by the best of the best in the writing world, the novel world. And that gives it credibility right off the bat that it wouldn't have if I self-published, even though it's the same book. So that's why I went through the New York people. And I think it's important because, again, we know what we can do in our industry with our family, our big extended family. They don't. So we have to show them, you know, and they're shocked. I mean, I just signed another 1,000 books for a bookstore that's a very important bookstore. You know, they had originally ordered 300, and I said, you know, you're probably going to be a little shy on this. And they sold them out in 2 hours. So I actually had to fly back down and sign another 1,000. Those are already sold out as of today. Wow. So it's 4 days. So I think they're really quite surprised at the strength and the support that we give each other in our industry. That's one of the great things about our world.
No doubt about it.
It's great to hear. You know, Lanny, I tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and tell you.
What you gonna tell me?
I got you a book.
All right.
For Christmas, I'll give it to you. I don't think you've read but one book since the second grade in your life, so this will be book number two.
Yeah. That's right.
Be excited. So, guys, I would encourage our audience. Mr. Jim, would you say one of the easiest places would just be to go to Amazon to buy it for them?
Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon anytime. I think the first edition is already sold out, so they're already having to go into a second edition on this novel. But you can order at Amazon, it'll be delivered right to your door. That's definitely, they're not going to be signed, but next time you see me at a convention or show or whenever I'm down on a whitetail hunt somewhere, everybody show up and I'll sign them for them.
Does your signature look the same on number one as it does 1,000?
Yeah. You know what?
That's pretty good.
I've signed a lot of checks. I have a lot of expenses in my life. So you can ask Toxie. Toxie, has yours changed at all? No. I mean, you get so good at doing it.
It's a yeah. T.
Toxie's is pretty, yeah. It's just like, it's
mine
so
looks
fast.
Like an electrocardiogram. It doesn't look like.
Very distinct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely not the same every time either.
Mr. Jim, one of the things I wanted to ask you, and I've got some notes here, but this Hand of Man Museum, I follow you on Instagram, and you just have the most interesting artifacts that you put on display there. At what point in your life did you say, I need to build a museum and house all this stuff?
When I was 10 years old, there was two things that I knew I would do with my life. In fact, two things that I was only going to do with my life. And that was create a museum of natural history and cultural art.
Wow.
At 10 years of age, I knew that. I started collecting seashells, pretty rocks, insects, and I borrow fishing lures from my dad's tackle box. My grandfather, with his tackle box, even better, I get older lures. So I started collecting for my museum at the age of 10. I knew where I'd go. I had National Geographic. I mean, I grew up in a trailer park, so it was, it was pie in the sky. But I could get the National Geographics from the library, and I could pick the places that I was going to go in my life, the people I wanted to see, the things I was going to gather. But at that same time, too, I wanted to write. I wanted to be a novelist. I was reading J.A. Hunter's book called Hunter. You know, three times in grade. I was 10 years old. I got to spend more time in detention reading that. But I knew I'd do both of those things. So the museum started back then. I still have my very first seashell that I ever collected, and then it's in the museum, and every single thing I've gathered together and kept. Wow. Eventually, you know, the collection got too big, and also it my intention was never to keep it. I don't believe you own anything. I think you're a steward of whatever the chattels, the object you have in your life. So, you know, it was meant to be for the public. And again, it's the Hand of Man Museum of Natural History, Cultural Arts, and Conservation. So there's an educational component to it that if you present hunting in the right way, we don't get any feedback. I mean, one in a thousand people, we keep track of it. We will have 30,000 visitors this year for donation only. I don't charge anything. There's, as I said, you know, when I grew up, it was trailer park. I couldn't have afforded a $1 cover charge. So we will always keep it as donation. And Louise and I started the process 2 years ago of donating everything, the land, building, the contents, and an endowment to cover expenses for the next 40 years. So it'll always be open by donation only. So anybody, even trailer park kids like me, could get into this museum and can get into this museum for four more decades. So everybody knows me for the hunting and traveling around the world, but I was actually gathering these bits and pieces from everywhere around the world, totem poles and statues and carvings. You know, costumes from the world, masks, all kinds of flint points, you know, and iron points. I spent more time looking at the ground than I did for animals when I was on these hunts and going to markets. I asked my cameraman, they wanted to get out in the mountains, and I'm going to a marketplace. So I just devoted my life, dedicated my life to putting this museum together, and the hunting was a byproduct of it. But the museum was actually the focus of my life.
Your daughter's been begging you to hunt since her little brother shot the big 8 last year. You've ran a fire, dissed the fields, got stuck, got unstuck. Planted food plots, fertilized, and prayed for rain. You moved trees, limbed roads, even bought one of those fancy cell cameras.
So what's your excuse?
LS Tractor.
Moultrie was first in feeders since 1979 and is the leader in total game management. They're taking feeding to another level with the new Ranch Series line of durable and versatile feeders, perfect for both wildlife and domestic livestock. So Dudley, you can feed your goats. Whether you're a deer hunter, a hobby farmer, a land manager, or a rancher, Moultrie has you covered with several kit options, including a rotating auger, broadcast, or a gravity kit. And these feeders are 300 or 450 pounds. They're big feeders. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount.
I was going to say, you bring a whole new definition to the word hunter-gatherer.
Yeah, so, you know, you've been on all these travels. I grew up watching you on TV, and like you said, a lot of it, instead of the hunt, you would be at a market, and, you know, you'd see all this culture and natural history in addition to the hunt. So I don't, you know, I'm not asking you to give us any spoilers, but I would like a little taste of your book if you can pull that off. But I'm assuming there is also a lot of culture in this book as well.
There's a lot of art in the book. You know, it's a lot of, I mean, the premise is that there is an organization that controls a lot of what goes on around the world, and they do it as to collect the finest pieces of art for basically the people that run the world at a special event every year, the gathering, they call them. And that organization is called Our World. And it's driven by the seven deadly sins, you know, the vices. So, you know, wrath and greed and
envy.
Envy, pride, you know. And I call it Our World because It's a metaphor for what we see around us. I mean, everybody, how far do you have to look to see major organizations, whatever they are, whether they're governments or not, that ascribe to those vices as their mandate? I mean, it's everywhere. And so Our World in this book is a metaphor. It's a deep state, but it certainly is a facing the fact that there's a lot of manipulation going around this world that by organizations that are supposed to be helping us, are looking after their people. So there's a young lady, she receives a manuscript in the mail, and the manuscript starts with the words, "Zhivago is dead. I hunted him down and I killed him." You know, now that those were words that I penned back in 1997 to start this novel, but I hadn't lived enough life yet to finish it. So I tabled it for another 25 years. But she receives this manuscript and realizes fairly quickly that it's talking to her in a second person perspective, which in the audiobooks, which if you guys, is it Dudley over there that hasn't read very many books, or who hasn't read very many books?
That's Lanny.
That would be Lanny, but I, okay. Yeah.
But that's, you can get it in audiobooks, and I read those second person perspectives. But this young lady gets this manuscript and realizes fairly quickly that it's about her and this organization that's looking for the greatest work of art that's ever been created by mankind. And the organization is 270 years old, and they don't know what this work of art looks like. So it's this evil organization that finds children that are gifted with the ability to recognize art. We would call it, you know, I guess, on the spectrum of autism, but to the point of being one in a billion, where you can recognize, you feel great art. And you know, this young boy, Hunter, in the book, can't read. He's 8 years old, and his teacher tells the parents to take him to a psychiatrist because he can't read. And they take him in and realize he's not only, you know, he's not interested. He can read at a level that's beyond university comprehension. He recognizes art at a level nobody can understand, and then gets recruited by this organization, Owl World. So that gives you a... He's the hunter in the book, and the villain is named Zhivago, that has similar talents, but is an evil animal rights extremist on the side. So, and I mean, he's evil. This character is evil. This young lady pursues the information that's in the novel on a cross-country trip that leads her to discovering who she is, her past, and her importance in the world, as well as the relationship to this fellow hunter. His name is Hunter. That's Call Me Hunter is the name of the book. So I don't want to give up any more than that, because I'll ruin all the twists and plot lines. But I, you know, it's you won't be able to put it down once you start getting into it. It's just, that's what every single person that reads it says.
Just the true stories written would be like, no, that's fiction. You can't believe it. So you've had so many to draw from. It's crazy.
Thanks, Toxie. Just on that note, my journals, I kept journals religiously my entire traveling career. And just my journals on Africa alone are over 1 million words. Wow. You know, all typewritten words. So wow. I've got that pared down to 180,000 that are fairly interesting words just on Africa. And I need to get it down to about 120,000 words for it to be a book.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at thefurminator.com.
So, Jim, let me ask you this. So, one of the things that I've always admired about you is your just the way you handle yourself in so many different ways. I mean, I just always admire the way you handle yourself, but I also admire the way you raised your kids.
Amazing.
And I was wondering if you might have some advice for some of our listeners that may have kids that are coming up and they're about to be at that age where they get taken hunting for the first time. And have you got any advice of introducing, especially young ladies, to hunting? You obviously did a great job there with Miss Eva.
Well, hey, that was Louise doing the great job with Miss Eva. You see all this gray hair I got? That's Miss Eva. That's what she did to me. And the true story is she was a professional dancer, went to university down in Australia, got her degree, and she came home at 21. And I remember Louise and I were sitting there, and Evie said, "You know, I'm thinking I want to learn how to hunt now." And she had not hunted. Well, once she shot a gopher when she was 6 years old and said it was temporary insanity. But 21 years of age, she chose. And I mean, Louise and I mean, our jaws dropped. You know, I said to her, "You know, you haven't talked to me since you're 14 years old, and now you want to hunt?" And she said, "Yep, I'm old enough now that you and I can be friends." So wow. The moral of that story is it's never too late. Yeah. And even if your daughter doesn't want to get into hunting necessarily right now, down the road, as long as you don't try and force it on. That's the advice I would give. It has to be their choice, and you'll see it genetically. Some people are hunters. They, you know, that 10%, that's just who they are, and it doesn't matter female, male. They're going to go out there and they're going to start at an early age, and that's what they're going to do. But there's a percentage that, you know, they need to be gently brought into the outdoors, you know, to show them the beauty of those mornings, the sunrises, the coyote wind as it blows by, the birds starting to wake up, the night owls, night creatures going to sleep, and that quiet moment that is such a spiritual time in that cathedral that is the outdoors. If you introduce them to it, you expose them to it. It doesn't mean they're going to embrace it, but they will never forget it. Never. And the more we go technological in today's world, I mean, someone told me a couple of days ago that the average child spends 6 minutes outside nowadays. Six minutes. And they say, you know, for healthy living, you know, these children should be 2 to 4 hours outside. They're getting 6 minutes. So, the kids are craving this touch, the ability to touch their ancestral souls. And the only way you can do that is to go outside. You cannot do that looking on these computers and these, you know, these cell phones. I mean, you can't do it. So the most important advice I can give is get these children outdoors. Let them breathe fresh air. Let them play. Go on a picnic and sit in the woods and let them actually play in the outdoors. That's a start to hunting. You know, it's all hunting. You know, the kill shot is that the mainstream media shows us as the thing we're interested in is like this much of what hunting is really about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's the outdoors. It's the camaraderie. It's the family. It's the spirituality. It's, you know, health. I mean, you just go on and on and on. And that's all part of what hunting's about. So get the children outdoors. Get your daughter outdoors, or your daughters, your sons. Get them outside for more than 6 minutes a day and be with them. Actually be with them. You know, that's what they're going to appreciate more than anything. That's what they're going to remember when they're late in their later years and they come back to you and say, "You know what? I want to learn how to hunt." But not, you can't force them to do it. You just have to expose them to the wonders of what we do. And all of us sitting here right now, everybody listening, we know it, but we may not, you know, we just assume that everybody else does. And children have to be shown, but they will 100% appreciate every minute that you take them in the outdoors. You don't have to kill something. You don't even have to have them sitting on a deer stand. You just have to be out there. And that's when they see you loving this pastime, you know, outdoors experience, they will come back to it because they'll remember the times that you took them out and did a picnic with them, found a butterfly, found a shed deer antler, if you're lucky, heard and saw squirrels, saw birds, a bird's nest. Maybe you saw a robin, you know, beautiful blue robin's egg laying on the ground and got to explain it to them if it's springtime. All of this, picking wild blackberries or whatever berries are in your area, they will remember this. And that's all part of hunting. So don't take them necessarily just for the kill part. Take them for the other parts of hunting that are so so important to the experience of being who we are.
Boy, there's some great advice right there.
No doubt. Yeah. You know, Jim, don't you think the age we're in today has actually shifted a little bit? Because it just feels like to me, and maybe I'm biased, being in an outdoor family and surrounded by all these great people here, but it just seems like that the hate and the evil and the divisiveness and all the just the rank political nature of everything today is just getting so bad that and you and I know and everybody in this room knows that just about the only antidote to that is the great outdoors and touching the face of God in nature and all the things you just described. Don't you feel like maybe it's getting so bad that when people do experience what you just described, they actually may grab onto it more than they did, say, in the late 90s. I just felt like we were under our greatest pressure at about that time. You can mm-hmm. look back like me on it. But it just feels like today people are starting to embrace more. And I guess the top, you know, you would be, in my opinion, the top spokesperson for what we do, is that everybody understands it is not about just pulling the trigger. It's part of the process. And then there's that innate connectivity that you get by taking an animal's life, but with that reverence that Jim does it with. You know, when people experience that, it's almost hard to put it in words. They just have to pick it up on their own. But it just, I don't know. I feel like more, and thanks to people like you, maybe more words getting out there. I just feel like we're gaining some ground because there's not much else to save what's going on today.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%, Toxie. We were, you know, in the 80s and 90s, environmentalism was a growth industry. You know, I mean, they were considered the number one domestic terrorist organization was animal rights groups.
Yeah.
In those days, you know, that's obviously changed. I think the people nowadays are starting to feel, I mean, COVID, you know, yes. COVID wasn't, that's not nature deciding to deal with 8 billion people on this planet. That was a shot across the bow. But all the people that have urbanized over the last 60 to 80 years, you know, the ones living in the 23rd floor of some fancy apartment building realized that with COVID, which wasn't a true pandemic, but they were locked in. They were actually, that 23rd floor apartment that they worked so hard for actually became a cell, a prison cell. And they realized that if a real true pandemic does hit, that'll become a tomb. Not just a prison cell, it's a tomb. So that was, I think, a real awakening for people, Toxie, that they started realizing that, boy, wouldn't it be nice? I see on TV the people that are growing their own garden,
yes,
that are picking apples from their own orchard, that are making their own wine from their own grapes, or dandelions, like my grandmother. You know, they have a dog, they've got sheep or goats or chickens, you know, they have food. And they're living outdoors and like nothing's happening. So I think that you're 100% right. There's a generation now that's been tired of being sold a bill of goods and the, you know, untruths and manipulated storylines that yes. just to sell newspapers. Bad news sells for $2, good news sells for $1. So, you know, these big corporations that own the newspaper, what do you think they're going to sell? They're going to sell bad news. And I think people are starting to see through that, Toxie, and realizing that they're not being told the truth. And this whole pandemic really started it. I mean, that's the number one concern right now on American citizens is that the government officials, their elected officials or unelected officials are not being honest with them. And you know, so that, you know, when you have that subversive effect on your everyday living, you start looking at things that are natural, like what is really true. Well, going out there,
yep.
walking in the woods, killing a deer, eating it—that's real. You know, there's not all the growth hormones and whatnot. It's not a factory-raised animal. You can barely get any sustenance from. You know, the people are starting to realize. So, Toxie, I wouldn't be surprised if there's, you know, a generation coming ahead here that. Is just going to say bull crap to all of that and let's de-urbanize. And I think you're starting to see that process starting.
people are running to space, I called it, after COVID. I mean, you look at the industries that collapsed and then the industries that persevered. I mean, hunting, fishing, boating, camping,
yeah,
you know, skiing, golf actually is out in open air and stuff. I mean, people grew exponentially those things that got them out in space. And although it's not quite as keen as it was right after COVID, it's still that trend is up and continuing to grow, which is really cool.
Yeah. And even though a lot of us have so many political differences, everybody, you know,
yeah,
people are learning, you know, the outdoors is what, you know, brings us together.
I made a note while you were talking before Dudley brought that up. When I wrote down, nature has no agenda, and it's so refreshing. Exactly what Dudley was just saying. You get out there, there's no agenda to bend people to your whatever way of thinking, right, left, in between, or whatever. It's just pure. It is so pure, you know, to connect with all that.
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Jim, I wanted to ask you, you've been hunting a long time. Can you remember back to when you were a youngster, I'm guessing maybe a 10, 11, 12 years old, and maybe your first hunting experience and maybe your first deer. Can you remember back to that event and tell us a little bit about that and how it turns you to say, okay, I'm going to be a hunter?
In fact, my earliest memory, period, was my dad and my uncles were tearing down a granary out at the farm, and they left me alone. And I think I would have been 3 years old. And I remember there was old bricks laying around, and I tipped over a brick and there was a big black beetle bug. And I tipped over another brick. There was a big long earthworm. And I started tipping these over and catching them. That instant, right then, I knew I'd be a hunter. I knew I was a hunter. It's not, you know, it's not what I do. It's who I am. And I went, you know, graduated from there to catching mice and trying to raise mice, much to my mother's chagrin. I realized too late, unfortunately, that mice could chew through a cardboard box gophers, snakes, we weren't eating them. I tried skinning them. I tried taxidermy. It was probably 5 years old. And then the rabbits, which we could actually eat. And I remember the sense of pride I had. And I would have been about 10 years old when I got my first rabbit. And I used to hunt them with pellet guns and snare them, whatever way I could catch them, and bow and arrow, actually. And I remember bringing it home, my first rabbit, and skinning it, not well. I mean, my poor mother and her cooking it, you know, like that. That was a seminal moment in my life. It was, I guess, the realization of what I was, you know, hunter, and I actually provided for my family. I gained self-confidence, self-reliance. I remember walking along with my little rubber cowboy boots with a star on the side of them and just thinking that I was the greatest thing. I mean, the self-confidence that it gave me, being a hunter and providing for my family, such as a rabbit, was, there's just, I wish that the insecure people in this world that lack self-confidence, which is a lot of problem nowadays because they don't know what they are or what they're supposed to do. I mean, we touched on it, he, she, we, us, it, if they felt that sense of pride and accomplishment, and I don't mean pride as a vice, I mean it as a virtue, I think it would solve a lot of the problems nowadays. And that's, for me, my earliest memories. First deer hunt, that was easy. It was my dad and my uncles. They, you know, to them, a deer was a hamburger running across a field. So opening day, they tried to tag up every deer that didn't matter, whatever it was, just shoot it. And I remember my dad, I was kind of noisy, I guess, and he put me with my uncle. And we were on stand. And, my uncle had to go to the bathroom, number two. And I was standing there. He put his gun against the old 30-30 lever action, put it against a tree. And he was doing his number two with, you know, and you had to have, those days they wore combinations, the big full suits of a color. And he had that pulled all the way down. And I saw this deer coming through the forest. And I would have probably been about five or six. And I was yelling at my uncle, you know, Uncle Cliff, Uncle Clunk, deer, deer, deer. So he jumped up, grabbed his 30-30, shot the deer right there in front of me as it ran by, and then went back and finished off his business. Never pulled up his pants. But he shot her again. So yeah, it was quite a traumatic experience, my first deer hunt.
Oh my goodness. That sounds like something that happened to you.
Yeah,
right?
It does. For sure. 100%.
So it sounds like your family had a ranch. I've heard you describe it. Were there a lot of deer up there then when you were young?
When my dad was young, there was none. The first deer that anybody got in the area was a huge deal. This is in Saskatchewan, Canada. There just wasn't deer there. You know, there was hardly any farming before that. So they, you know, the country is too harsh without farming for the deer to survive the winters. But with more and more farming moving further and further north, the deer actually moved further north as well. When I was young, there wasn't as many deer. The deer population hit its peak back about, you know, Milo Hansen's era there, 1993 through 2007. I'm talking about Saskatchewan. Since then, I haven't taken a client since 2012. We had a bad winter in 2007, didn't take anybody for 5 years, and deer came back a little bit, took hunters in 2012, and we did really well. Bad winter that year, 13 and 14, pretty much wiped out the deer. So I haven't taken a hunter or client in my whitetail territory. I have 40 tags, have a lodge, and I haven't taken anybody other than Eva, her daughter, and Tim, her husband, twice maybe. So the, you know, deer do what deer do. You know, the population rises and falls. But at the beginning in Saskatchewan, there were no white-tailed deer. That's all come in because of, you know, they live symbiotically with us. So when there's crops, they eat well and they can thrive the winter. And farmers get rid of the predators, the wolves, you know, the cougars, whatever, grizzly bears, whatever's killing the deer or predating on them. So that allowed the deer to expand into the Saskatchewan terrain, even though it's right on the marginal edge of their ability to survive.
Yeah, that sounds like it would have been an incredible place to grow up as a young man, just a lot of adventures just right there at your fingertips.
I would leave home every morning at 5:30 in the summer and go hunting. I mean, I just carried my air gun, pellet gun, air rifle across the highway, and I was hunting for rabbits or, you know, old barns looking for rats. It was wonderful. But you know, again, we didn't have a lot of money, so if Dad didn't get a moose every year, we didn't eat meat in the wintertime. It was macaroni for us. So, you know, there was also the serious side of the hunting for my family anyway when I was growing up.
Boy, a moose, now that's a lot of meat.
What do you think's your favorite venison or meat? You've shot everything in the world.
Yeah, well, remember, that's a pretty big question for me. But the best wild game meat that I've ever had is paca down in Central America, South America. It's a nocturnal rodent. Wow. You've probably heard of capybara. They're the largest rodent in the world. That's the Brazilian name. They're also called ronsoco and carpinchi, depending if you're in Paraguay or Peru. But they are fabulous eating wow. rodents. But the one that's the next size down to the carpinchi or the capybara is the paca. And that, to me, is the best of all wild game meat. That, and really close second would be a brush-tailed porcupine from Africa, West Africa. Wow. I mean, they're just isn't they're just exquisite.
Come on.
Yeah, I was not expecting
expecting the point.
I actually was expecting.
They're in a special category of wild game meat. And I don't know why, but the Asian deer species are really, really good eating. Anybody that's hunted down in Hawaii on Lanai with Pineapple Brothers can attest to that. They're just really hard to beat access here. After that, I'd say moose.
Yeah.
That's what I grew up on. So I just love moose.
It's hard to beat, honestly. Caribou.
Yep. I'm such a crappy elk hunter that I've eaten a lot more caribou in my life than elk. So I like caribou as well.
Do you have any advice that you could give our listeners in the way that we behave out there so that we're perceived by the public that really doesn't care about hunting one way or another so that we could work to improve the way we're viewed by them? And I'm talking about something as simple as, you know, a lot of us, Lanny's guilty of this, riding around with his tailgate down to show off his deer. So then, you know,
I put mine on the hood.
But that's right. But I mean, there's got to be little things that we could do to kind of clean up our act that could help us. And just wanted your thoughts there.
There's a segment of us that says, I don't care. You know, I don't, those idiots don't, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do.
And that's a lot of people.
You know, that doesn't work in today's world. Mm-mm. You know, there's a lot more of us. The bottom line is there's a lot more of us. And what you could do with like-minded people in those days, you shouldn't do it anymore. You should think about the people that you're impacting by your statement. And not everybody understands hunting. So, you know, we have to stop thinking about, well, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do and I don't care. We have to stop thinking like that as individuals and start thinking about what's best for all of us listening, for all of us, bigger picture. Okay, maybe I don't have to stand like an oak in that hurricane and just and get blown over and die. Maybe I can be like a willow and just let the hurricane blow by, and you know, I bend a little bit, but I'm still there at the end of it. And I think if we want to be tolerated by that 80% that doesn't hunt, and we need them, you know, 10% will never reach. They hate us, and you know, it's ideological. They just will not. You know, it's cognitive dissonance if we try and explain to them conservation and that it actually helps wildlife. It doesn't fit in their ideology, so they ignore it and they have to vilify it, like I said before, marginalize us. But the 80% out there that don't hunt, you know, those are the ones that we have to respect and tolerate their lack of understanding about us and what we do. And in so doing, you know, give them our message, give them our story in a way that is acceptable. Not, I got my dead deer and I'm going to put it on my hood. You know, it's just that those days are done. If we want to be around in three more generations, we have to start realizing that 80%, they don't understand what we do. So all they get is what the press tells them, that we're, you know, louts that spit on the floor and don't have any higher sensibilities. You know, that's our stereotype. And every time that we walk right into that and do that, then we're hurting hunters and hurting hunting. We may feel good that we're tough and we didn't take any guff from somebody, whatever. That, you know, that's a self-serving, arrogant, yes, egotistical way to act when you should be acting on behalf of all hunters and all hunting. You know, we can't even separate the hunting to say, I only kill what I eat. You know, I only eat meat, you know, and I kill these wild game. That's all I do. And, you know, there's some very articulate people saying that, which is wonderful. But, okay, well, what about the people that are predator hunting? You know, they're maintaining, you know, managing the predators. So they're bad. You know, what about the people that go to places like Africa, spend their money on safaris, that the local villagers then get, you know, fresh water wells, they get teachers and schools built, they get their roads built, you know, they get hospitals built because of the dollars from hunters. So someone that says, oh, I eat meat and I do it right, I'm the only kind of hunter that's the right kind of hunter, and those trophy hunters that go to Africa are the wrong guys, you know, it'll get you out of an argument in a cocktail party, for sure, they'll say, oh, yeah, you're okay, but those guys are bad. But wait a minute. That's not the truth. The fact is, those people going to Africa that are spending their money there are helping the people there. And until we deal with the poverty issue in those places, you're never going to solve the wildlife issue. They're going to continue to kill the wildlife until you make the wildlife worth more money. It's just economics 101. So we have to, within our own community, not throw sticks and stones at each other. And we just have to take an honorable approach, take the high road, and do what's right for all of us, not just for me, myself, and I on a given day.
Lead by example.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, big time.
If there ever was a chance to say amen,
yes,
let's say amen. Amen.
The word I was going to say to answer him, though, was a word that sticks in my mind a lot of times, mindfulness. Yeah. If you are mindful of all around you, which the outdoors will teach you to be better at in life, then you will care what people think, not for your own whatever satisfaction, but because you care about what we do. Listen to him. He cares so much about the lifestyle and hunting, you know, as just a way of being. So he's got that mindfulness. He's paying attention all the time.
The last few months, you've had some tough times.
Yes.
And we watched how you dealt with that. And you set an example on that as well. And our heart has gone out to you in the last few months.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. The outpouring of support has been amazing. But you know, I'm okay. You know, Louisie had the rough ticket on that one for 2 years. But we had a year and 11 months to say goodbye. And she was just so strong. I mean, you know, every one of us should aspire to that. You know, you can't do anything about it. It is what it is. So you can make those last days of your life, weeks, months. You can make it horrible. You can make it hell, or you can just realize that, you know, life begets death, begets life, begets death, and embrace those days. So make every day precious. And that's what she did, and she smiled it to the very end. I mean, she was an angel from heaven. I was with her for 39 years, 113 days, 14 and a half hours. And you know, I'm blessed. I was blessed. So to look back and now feel sorry for myself, you know, throw a tantrum, kick and scream, or, you know, why me, why me? I was with an angel. You know, she came from heaven and went back to heaven. And she wanted me to move on. So, you know, I won't denigrate that memory of that amazing fairy tale we lived by feeling bad for myself. I was the luckiest guy in the world. So it's how you look at things. And we just, you know, it's easy to look at what was me. I'm depressed, but that's not the way to look at it. You know, it's what a blessing. Mm-hmm. What an amazing experience to have that time with a soulmate. You know, that's how you have to look at it and look at the generations that are still here, our children and our grandchildren. So, no, I'm fine, everybody, and I appreciate that. I really, truly do.
You know, I have to say that I've used analogies a lot, but one of my favorites is, like, you see their picture in the dictionary next to what word. For her, her picture's right there permanently next to the word grace. She just had an unbelievable just aura about her of grace, not just the class and everything else too, but just that grace, and not just gracefulness, just a grace about everything. It was just incredible. Everything you could just watch her, and not even, she wasn't even talking. You could see it. She exuded so much. And the other thing, another great saying is, and you just alluded to it, is that crisis does not create character. It reveals character. And so when he's thrown a curveball like this, you can't prepare. It brings out who she really is and who he really is. And I couldn't be prouder for that, because people that have seen him in the entertainment and adventure and everything he's done, the most productive life I've ever known in our world. But know behind the scenes, this guy has got the greatest class and dignity in a family with grace. I mean, her daughter is the same way.
Yeah.
I've got to be in camp a few times with her. And I mean, I'm just telling, and I told you privately, I've never seen a classier young lady. I never have. And so I just think it's important that people, when they hold him up as an example to be like for all his accolades in hunting, first and foremost is the integrity with which he handles himself in life. And people need to know that. I just had to say it because I've witnessed it in a lifetime of being around him.
Thank you, Toxie. That means a lot coming from you, especially. I mean, you're right back at you on everything you said.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
For the example set, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Hey, so it's a great example. So, guys, I assume a lot of our listeners already follow him, but if you don't follow him, you ought to. It's just great information, but there's a great example of how to live your life right there.
Yeah.
And then I would also encourage everybody to go to Amazon and if you're not a reader, a lot of times guys aren't readers like Lanny. He doesn't like, but Lanny's wife likes to read, and this book would be awesome for her. So I would encourage everybody. Christmas is coming up. This is a great chance to support Jim Shockey and
the hunting community as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want things to roll for him because I want to see more and more what's coming after this.
Absolutely. And look, before we leave, we would love for you to come down here at some point and go hunting with us. Turkey hunting, deer hunting, duck hunting, whatever you wanted to do, we'd love to have you down here.
Yeah, be careful.
I'd love to come. And believe me, now I have a little more time in my life, so I'm going to be knocking on your door. Somebody's saying, remember me? Remember me? You invited me down? So hopefully you remember me.
Oh, we will. We'll put you on a bulldozer or a tractor or something.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of that.
Yeah, we will. I might have to get me a black cowboy hat. I think I'd look good in one.
Bobby. Richie.
Yeah, wait, Richie.
That'll work. That'll work.
Mr. Jim Shockey, thank you so much for being here.
Yes.
And from everybody at Mossy, we just admire you so much. And we really do. I mean, I know this is kind of getting gushy here at the end.
But. No, but I mean, it's just how it is. I mean, one thing, you start losing people like her. I still go back to Bob Dixon. What a shock that was to assistant for all us. That's 20 years ago. Mm. But you get in the habit after a while is don't let the people that you think so much of and love, don't let time pass and not let them know how you feel. Just don't do it, you know.
And I'll say something else. It kind of makes me feel good about life when I see that he has a hard time with some of his cell phone and hooking up where the
that just proves he's the real deal, guys.
He is
the real deal.
He's a lot more interested in rifles and bows and arrows than he is cell phones.
Amen. Amen to that one.
I don't know what else to say, guys. Is there anything else that needs to be added, Lanny?
Go get your Christmas presents.
Yeah. Go check the book out. And, you know, like you said, appreciate what you do is representing the hunting community as a whole. No doubt about it.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's a high accolades coming from you guys. I appreciate that.
Look, this episode with the LS Tractors, our sponsor, and our new sponsor, Sheffield Financial, we've just kind of overshot some of those opportunities, but we wanted to bring this kind of without any – we just wanted to hear from Mr. Jim.
Absolutely.
So that's what we wanted to do, guys. So we'll get back on track next week. It's been an honor to have Jim Shockey here with us today in our little humble studios, and – I'm just so excited, and I don't know what else to say. So why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast, and be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife magazine, and don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.